Welcome to my favorite podcast with Noah Marger.
With the taste of your lips, I'm on a ride. You're toxic, I'm slipping under the taste of a poison paradise. I'm addicted to you, don't you know that you're toxic? I love what you do, don't you know that you're toxic? Don't you know that you're toxic? That was Toxic by Britney Spears. Everyone's favorite fucking song. My favorite song. Truly, though, one of her best. Watch that conservatorship documentary about her and her dad and every the bullshit that's going on there. And I was like, yikes. Maybe I know who that song's about. Maybe I know who that song's about maybe a little bit now. That's one of her best. Lucky, kind of an underrated Britney cut. She's good. I like her. I like Britney, okay? Everyone needs to stop saying that I don't like Britney because I like her. She's cool. She's got a great Instagram. You guys got to follow that Instagram. It's fucking awesome. Welcome to my favorite podcast. It's a podcast about people's favorite things. The host of the show, whether you like it or not. Probably not. Noah Marger. Welcome back to another beautiful episode. I'll say it. I'm not afraid to say it. We got a beautiful episode. we got some silliness. We got some chills, some thrills. So we're gonna be all over the fucking map today, guys. It's about to be electric. It's about to be fucking electric up in here. And I got just the guest who's gonna help me bring the pain. This guy, I know this guest is notorious for bringing the pain wherever she goes, and this is gonna be no exception. I'm expecting full throttle. Here we go. My guest today is a writer and comedian who's known for her work on ABC's Speechless. She is a living legend, and she needs no introduction, but I'm giving her a bad one anyway. Please welcome to the show, Jackie Quinn. Jackie, what's up?
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. Did the little introduction that I wrote for you at the very end, did that suffice? Was that working for you?
Oh yeah, it works, and you better hope that it worked because I bring the pain.
You bring the pain. I'm literally talking to someone who can end my life at any single moment. She's got a big red button in that room right now, and if something's not working for her during this episode, all she got to do, press that motherfucker, and then I'm done. So, where's that clock at right now? That like once I hit midnight, how far are we away from midnight right now? And you hitting that button?
You're at about 10:30 p.m.
Oh, thank God. It can only get so much worse from here, Jackie. You can only approach midnight so quickly.
It's rapidly moving.
Oh, fuck. Well, enjoy the last episode of my favorite podcast while you guys got it. Might be a new host. Maybe it'll be Mason next week fucking taking over this show. Who knows? What's the vibe today, Jackie? What's the vibe?
The vibe is I have been on Zoom for 3 hours, so.
Damn, you were on Zoom before this?
Yeah.
Damn.
Were you? People you wanna... are still Zooming, huh?
Can you say what you were doing on Zoom for 3 hours, or is it top secret?
No, I signed up for a writing class.
Oh, nice.
So I'm just putting in the time, you know?
Sure. Is the class just sort of a general write what you want type thing? Are you focusing on anything in particular?
It's a pilot class, so.
Nice. Hell yeah. Nice.
Hell yeah.
We're hearing a lot of pitches for, okay, guys, what if two roommates moved to Los Angeles? That type of stuff. Is it mostly two roommates moved to Los Angeles, the class?
Yeah. Six people, and they're a bunch of friends. But we won't call it friends, you know?
Call it pals. Pals, roommates, buddies. You guys know. You got, and you'll love it. People will eat that shit up. They'll eat the slop that we feed them because we're just trying to watch Friends. That's really what we're all trying to do at the end of the day is watch Friends.
Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah. Jackie, can I ask you Noe's question? Is that something I'm allowed to do? Can I ask you?
I'll allow it.
Okay, perfect. Hey, listen, I know you got that big red button over there, so gotta run all this shit by you anyway, but here we go.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba, it's Noe's question.
Jackie, I have a very normal question for you, okay? It's very normal. just curious. Have you ever startled Modest Yahoo during a radio interview for chance? Is that maybe something that's happened in your life? I just, you know, it's a normal question I ask every guest. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm probably the first guest that can answer yes.
You are, actually. I ask that to every single guest, and everyone's like, what the fuck are you talking about, dude? And the clock just goes 1 second to midnight for everybody, and I'm just like, yeah, that makes sense. That's fair. What happened? What happened between you and Modest Yahoo?
Oh, man, that's so funny. The summer before college, I worked at a local radio station, 88.9 Radio Milwaukee.
They're Let's great. Go.
And yeah, I was doing an internship there and I had to talk to my boss and he was in the recording booth and I was told like I can come in whenever, you know, be respectful and quiet and everything, but I had headphones on. So I didn't realize that we had a guest currently on air.
Sure.
So I like opened the door and who do I see but Modest Yahoo mid beatbox. And he stopped to look at me. I wasn't like I was like trying to like interrupt everything, but he was mid beatbox. So
damn,
I stopped the flow.
Damn, that like he remembers that. Like he's like sending his boys to find you. You had any run-ins with some Jewish reggae rapper like posse, some like hoodlums? You ever run into anyone on the street being like eyeing you, giving you the side eye?
Yeah, I have to stay away from, like, West LA.
from Pico Robertson, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Damn. She's wanted out there, folks. We got a fucking criminal on the podcast. We got a wanted woman. What was the aftermath of that? Like, was it just sort of business as usual? Did he say anything?
No, I never talked to him. My boss laughed at me about it. He's like, come on. Like, he's like, you interrupted the flow.
Damn, that's what he was most pissed about is that he wanted to keep hearing the beatbox. He wasn't pissed that you like scared Modest Yahoo possibly and was like, maybe this guy's gonna leave. He's like, dude, I was enjoying the fucking beat. Come on, bro.
Yeah.
Damn, that's brutal. You ever startled anybody? Any other celebrity startlings in your life?
None comes to mind. I did meet Kid Rock once, but I don't think I startled him.
He startled you, I have to imagine. Yeah. What was the occasion that you met Kid Rock? That's got to be a weird one.
Yeah. So it was MDA, Muscular Dystrophy Association, like their 100th celebration in Milwaukee. And they had like a big concert and like Dan Aykroyd was there. And like I remember having him sign something of my brother's Ghostbusters thing. But Kid Rock was there. I was probably like 9 or something. Like I was little.
So you go up to him and you're like, what's up, kid? And just do the whole Kid Rock thing. And he's like, okay, just signing some bullshit. Right before the pandemic started, I was working a job that had me sort of driving around LA, like taking photos of certain things. And I ended up in Atwater Village. I think I've said this on either this show or it's on the list. So I apologize for anyone who's maybe heard me say this 300 times already, but Jackie, for you, I was driving around LA, was taking some photos. So they wanted very specific looking, like modern, but also like futuristic looking, like townhouses or whatever. And so I went to Atwater Village to take a photo of these townhouses. And who do I see putting a table in the back of his car is America's Funny Man, Greg Turkington, of all people. Just loading this table into the back of his car with some other dude who I didn't know at all. And I'm such a huge fan of On Cinema, such a huge like Neil Hamburger, like that like whole realm of things, that I was so scared to approach him that all I could do was look at him. And it was like a quick glance because I didn't want him to see that I was looking at him. So I just turned and looked at him real quick. And he happened to catch my glance in his eye, and we both just turned away from each other really fast, and he got in the, his like Ford Explorer or whatever with this other dude and just drove away. And I was so ashamed. I was so little and small in that moment. I was pissed off, but I had that. So I've also startled a celebrity of certain stature. So
yeah, I mean, and he was on his way dealing with tables. Right?
I know, right?
Tables.
He's got to go see a man about tables. Your guy had to go beatbox for all of Milwaukee. Well, you know, it is what it is. We take what we can get out here in the mean streets of Atwater Village and in the mean streets of Milwaukee in the stew. Well, thank you for sharing that little story about Modest Yahoo. A little birdie told me maybe I should be asking about that. A little bird, quite literally a little bird, if you catch my drift on that one. But thank you for answering that. That's very fun. Jackie.
No problem.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, of course. Jackie, I said to you, please come on my show. You said only if I can end your life at any moment that I want to. And I said, that's fine. I'll take it. I'll take whatever I can get. And I said, you can talk about whatever you want. You said, can we talk about Mr. Burns, a post-electric play? Why did you pick Mr. Burns, a post-electric play? And why did you make me read something for this podcast? The first guest in history to give me a fucking homework assignment. Why did you pick this?
Yeah, first and foremost, I wanted to, you know, add some culture to Noah Marger's life.
Thank God. Because everyone who listens, literally anyone who listens to my podcast know that I need more culture in my life. Fucking watching Family Guy too much. I need a little bit of literature in my life. Okay, fair enough.
Well, okay, so let me start. It's my favorite play.
Let's go.
So that's why I picked it, and I think that not a lot of people know about it, so I'm excited to share.
Sure.
Even with you. And
yeah, okay.
I will say, though, like, plays are meant to be performed, right? So
absolutely.
I think it's a good read, but I, like, would encourage anyone who's interested in it to try to, like, find a production to see it. So
sure. Yeah, the only recordings of it that I could find online were high school productions, and yeah. I was like, I don't know if I want my first glimpse of what this looks like on stage to be sullied by, you know, George Abernathy Jr. Middle School's production of Mr. Burns. I'm like, I don't know if I want to go down that road. So I actually shielded myself from the YouTube recordings just to have it, just the pure written experience. But you're right. This absolutely needs to be seen to be 100% believed. Have you actually seen it performed live?
Yeah, so I saw it before I read it.
Okay.
I first saw it in Chicago. It's called Theater Wit is the what would you call that? I guess the theater that performed it, and they're performing it right now. There's a run through November right now.
Mason, so, listen to this. Mason, go see this play, bro.
See it. It blew my damn mind. I saw it my senior year of college. I was in a playwriting class. And one of the homework assignments was to go see a play.
Of course.
So, I looked this up. It looked awesome. And, I am such a, I love The Simpsons. So I was just like, great. This play sounds like right up my alley.
Sure.
And then I went there and I like sobbed on the train back to campus. Yeah. So.
Wow.
Moved me.
Is that the old purple line? Are we on the purple line? Okay, let's go. Noah knows his CTA just a little bit these days. I had some fucked up adventures on the CTA this summer when I was in Chicago. I don't know if they actually, I guess the CTA itself wasn't fucked up. The CTA is actually good, I think, all things considered. Yeah. It's actually like runs well, you know, like compared to like the subway, which is really like my only other like adventure with like a public train, you know, or like Amtrak like once in my life, you know. It was pretty good, I'm not gonna lie. There's just some circumstances surrounding some of those trips where I was like barely getting on the train. I was like, fuck, I need to get on this red line at Addison and right now. Just stressed out of my mind. But I'm glad that did you get on the purple line okay that day? Wasn't stressful?
Yeah, I was okay. It was with my friend Lauren. We went. But Yeah, it was fun. I think I had to end up taking like an accessible taxi to the
Sure.
stop, because a lot of CTA stops like aren't accessible, so I can go on like half of them or whatever it is.
Damn.
But it was fine. We made it. We cried. It was great.
You had a little cry on the Purple Line. Love that.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I hope to have also a cry on the Purple Line one day so I can Matt, we can compare notes about what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, at least mine was like because I was moved by art and not because all the other times I've cried on the Purple Line.
Probably, it sounds like maybe the top echelon of crying on the Purple Line. Hell
Yeah,
yeah.
I
We
think
always
so.
strive for that. What is your history with The Simpsons? Because this is a very multi-layered thing that we're talking about. It is a play that's based on more or less an episode of The Simpsons. So what is your history with The Simpsons? When did they sort of enter your life? How has your relationship changed to The Simpsons as you've gotten older? Or how has it stayed the same?
Sure. Great question.
Cool. Thanks. Oh, thanks. It's almost like I thought really hard about it and then wrote it down because I knew you were going to be on the show. But no, please.
yeah, so I think like I am the youngest of four children, which
Nice.
means that I could watch whatever the fuck I wanted.
Let's go. Hell yeah. Mom and dad. No. I'm watching Wild and Out right now. Come on.
Yeah, so I have like very early memories of watching The Simpsons, whereas like my oldest brother, who's 10 years older than me, was like forbidden to watch it because that
Nice.
was at the time where my parents were like trying to be good, lawful parents or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, Bart Simpson saying "Eat my shorts" is like the most evil thing in the entire world in like 1990 or whatever it is.
Yeah, like so I actually have a Simpsons tattoo on my leg that I
Oh.
got. I got in 2017, I want to say, a couple years ago. And my brother, when he found out, he was like, I literally had to sneak watching The Simpsons because mom and dad wouldn't let me. And now Jackie gets a Simpsons tattoo on her thigh. Like, this is bullshit. He still harbors a lot of feelings about how we were
Damn.
brought up.
Damn. You guys need to have had an intervention for this guy. Just be like, it's okay. Things you can watch with Ed the Simpsons anytime you want now, bro. Come on. Like, let's be real here. What tattoo do you have on your leg, perchance?
Yeah, on my thigh, I have a tattoo of Old Gil, and he's on
Oh.
his knees begging.
Just give old Gil, just cut old Gil a break. Love that.
it's a reminder to stay desperate, so.
Stay desperate. Hey. You don't need to tell me to remind you to stay desperate. I'm talking to a guy who does two podcasts. Let's have some perspective here. Okay, so Simpsons is a early on sort of memory for you. How does it evolve? How does your relationship to evolve or not evolve with it as you get older?
Well, okay, so I have a really bad memory. Like
Okay.
I can't be like quizzed on Simpsons trivia because like I'm not gonna do well.
Okay.
It's a really like important thing to me. An important show, and every time I watch it, I laugh like a little kid, and I think that's important.
Yes.
But I don't want to say like, you don't want to like call yourself a Simpsons aficionado because then people are gonna quiz you on it,
Sure,
Like they're gonna try
absolutely.
to prove themselves superior. And I'm like, you are superior. That's fine.
It's fine. I'll literally let you be smarter about Simpsons trivia. That's fine. That's totally fine. Okay. So you're not going to be able to tell me what color Homer's tie was in
No.
episode or whatever, but it still makes you laugh to this day.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't say I haven't watched new episodes, but
Fair.
I still rewatch like seasons 3 through 11.
So that's for you, sort of the prime is 3 through 11.
Yeah, you could argue 8, but I think 8 through 11 is still pretty good too.
I'm willing to go as far and say 3 through 9 is like the prime. I have less
Cool.
experience with 10 and 11 as far as considering it the prime. But I think I started watching The Simpsons in like season 15 or 16, like around
Oh,
then.
wow.
And so that to me is like very like heartwarming and nostalgic to see like that era of Simpsons when like lots of people are like leaving the show, you know, and just like not having as much of like a special relationship to it. But like early to mid to or like excuse me, mid to late 2000s is like when I started watching the show because to me it was forbidden fruit because I'm the oldest. Mm. Like I was not allowed to watch that, not allowed to watch My Favorite Family Guy, not allowed to watch South Park for so long. South Park, like the longest, I wasn't allowed to watch that until like sophomore year of high school, I don't think. However, when my mom would go to work in the summers and it would just be me and my sister at home, maybe the babysitter hadn't come yet. Oh, maybe I'd go on South Park Studios and watch the World of Warcraft episode in her room by myself. Maybe. And if you're hearing that now, mom, that did not happen. That was just a made up thing that we're all thinking about. I'm just painting a picture for the audience. But adult animation rocks. I'm just going to say it. I'm allowed to say that, right?
You're allowed. I'll allow it. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank God. Thank God. So you're seeing this play, you're a big Simpsons person. What was the like feeling that you felt when you first like saw this play? Like, was it inspiration? Was it this emotional release? Like, what was that feeling when you first see this, your two worlds coming together?
Oof. Yeah, I think, well, I don't want to give anything away yet. Basically, I think it's all about the power of storytelling, right? Like,
sure.
That's what I take away from this play. And as someone who was senior year, about to graduate college, moved to LA to write TV.
Right.
It was very much like, I'm making the right decisions, and right. I'm as important as a doctor.
Which, let's be honest, they're more important. TV writers are more important than doctors and surgeons and nurses and all those people out there. So you are right. You are 100% right on that.
Yeah. So I think a dose of like inspiration of like, look what is possible through written word and performances. But also it's just like my mom loves the theater.
Okay.
So I grew up going to like musicals and plays with her. So I'm like accustomed to it and I like it. And the sets and the costuming in this show is like unbelievable. That's why when I also saw there's like high school productions of it, and I'm like, what are they doing? They don't have the budget for this, you know, like talent aside, I'm just like, what? But you know,
get your dad's
hopefully
white,
I'm wrong.
Yeah, get your dad's white polo shirt out of the closet to just do Homer as best you can at the fucking 10th grade level. But you were going to see shows and stuff like with your mom like all throughout your life. So, did you like, were you a part of productions? Were you like involved in that kind of stuff? Like in high school, middle school, like what was your involvement actually in like live performance?
Yeah, sure. So, I did like the school musical from fourth grade to eighth grade.
Yes, bro.
It was like once a year I was in the musical. And I was fine. You know what I did? That's like so mortifying at the time. And now I can laugh at it. I was told, like, not during like dress rehearsals, like during live performances, more than once that I would mouth my co-star, that's so funny. co-star's lines while they were talking.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So like, and it was completely like, I didn't know I was doing it. But they would be saying their lines, and I would be mouthing their lines on stage.
Wow. And everyone's looking at you instead because you're mouthing the same lines that are happening right now. It's a little ventriloquist act happening right on stage. What shows, like, do you remember, like, was it a specific show that you can remember, like, oh, fuck, I'm mouthing these lines right now?
Yeah, it was when the first one that I got told was, I think that was eighth grade. I was in Cinderella, the Brandy version, Rogers Hammerstein.
Yep.
I was the queen, so I was Whoopi Goldberg's character.
Let's go.
And I'd have my scenes with my son, the prince, and my husband, the king, and I would be mouthing their lines as they talked.
Damn. Wow. Yeah. And they had pitchforks and torches backstage waiting for you. Stop stealing my fucking thunder, Jackie. Damn.
Yeah.
Brutal.
So bad. Oh, I felt so bad. And then I did this other thing. It's called like forensics. It's really like a bunch of different. You didn't have forensics at your school, did you?
I don't know what that. Well, I took a class in college called forensics, but it was like a science class.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, tracing the Chuck dead body thing.
Sure.
It's like we had it in middle school, and it was kind of like speech and debate, but there are all these different categories.
Okay.
And I did the category 1 year. You had to pick one for the whole year, and that's what you like competed in against other schools. And we did infomercial, which was really fun because me and my friend partnered up and we had to make an infomercial. And I was told that you'd go to a competition and there'd be judges, and written on a piece of paper would be like, the blonde one keeps mouthing the other one's lines. So it was a reoccurring issue for me.
Damn, yeah. You've actually been mouthing everything I've been saying to you this entire time, because I sent you the script for this podcast. I sent you the script, the written out script for this podcast. Everything you're hearing right now, completely scripted, by the way. Yeah, they're never going to know what the fuck is going on, because this is an audio medium. So they're fucked in that regard. The audience is fucked on this one. When did you get interested in writing for the stage specifically? Did that sort of just occur naturally when you're like, oh, I'm interested in writing for TV? Or when did that sort of spark?
Sure. So, yeah, I took acting class in high school just as the elective.
Sure.
And we had to write one short play. And then mine was selected to get performed with a couple others. And that was it for me. Like, once I heard people laughing at jokes that I wrote, I was like, okay, game over. How do I do this forever? But yeah, so that was just in high school, just plays. But it was, I didn't watch it live, but I watched, I think, DVDs of Arrested Development a couple of years after it was off the TV. And off air. And that was when I was like, oh, TV writing is an option. Like, because I loved that show and I thought it was so funny. And I was like, someone's coming up with these jokes.
Right. Yeah. And not just manatees like South Park, whatever you believe about my favorite show, Family Guy, putting balls and fucking things and being like, oh, I guess that's what we're putting out on the screen. Yeah, there's human beings coming up with jokes for Arrested Development. They actually had the budget to have people come up with those. I haven't done a rewatch of Arrested. I watched that show when I was like probably 14 for the first time, when it was like on Netflix and stuff. Haven't done a rewatch of it since. What is it about specifically about Arrested Development that really got you, just like the cleverness of everything, or like what really spoke to you in terms of that show?
Yeah, well, first, I think it's like, it's still hard. I can't pick a favorite character from that show.
Sure.
I think that cast and the performances, like, so stacked. Like, yeah, I think they have a really good ensemble. Even like, what, the boring one, I guess, is like Portia.
Yeah, Lindsay. Yeah.
But I'm like, she's still funny too. So anyway, I think it's got, they're all very funny characters and they do right by them. And yeah, I like meta jokes. So sure. I think it does a really good job of like weaving storylines and wordplay and all that. I don't know. Yeah, it just really clicked for me, being like, it was the first show where I was like, oh, someone is behind the scenes making this.
Sure. Yeah, you feel that like, the, like, I guess, for lack of a better term, the auteur-ness of that show. You know, yeah. I guess, to use a shitty film school term that nobody likes. But you do feel like the artist's signature, like, on, like, a network show, which, you know, in the 80s or whatever, Married with, or I guess that was, you know, Fox or whatever, but, like, Married with Children, you know, mm-hmm. Wings, whatever. You're not really necessarily feeling, maybe, the artist's, like, signature, I guess, in terms of, like, a creative thing. But that show, you, like, can't help but feel it. It feels so singular, you know, so that makes sense.
Totally. And it has the like live action cartoon energy to it. And as we established, I love The Simpsons. I love the cartoon. I think that, you know, even though The Simpsons is written by all like Harvard people, I think that they're like Itchy and Scratchy. You look at them and it's just zany, dumb shit.
Yes.
That tickles me. So.
That's the best shit, is the dumb stuff, I think, to be honest with you. That's when my brain kicks into overdrive and I'm like, oh, yes, it's so stupid what I'm watching right now. This is the best. And your favorite show is Family Guy, too. Like, I can say that, like, pretty confidently that you love Family Guy more than The Simpsons, right? Like, I'm allowed to say that for you?
No,
all right, maybe by the end I'll have you say that. Maybe I'll pivot this entire conversation and be like, so let me tell you a little bit about Family Guy. let me break down for you why it's the best TV show of all time.
No, you know what, so it sounds like you were watching Simpsons in the like animation domination lineup, right?
Absolutely. Is that like, yeah,
Okay, so I was watching Simpsons 6 o'clock. Usually we'd be like eating dinner and Simpsons would be on next to us, even.
Yes.
Like sometimes my mom would be like turning it off, but usually we'd have it on the background. But then Family Guy would come on after it and we'd switch the channel to Seinfeld.
Oh,
Yeah,
breaking
that's how
my fucking
much.
heart, dude. I mean, listen, Seinfeld, one of my favorite shows of all time, so I can't be too heartbroken, but
Yeah.
that is a Sophie's choice, Seinfeld or Family Guy at dinner with the family. Damn. But good for your mom for just taking control in that moment and being like, yep, we're not watching the talking baby. We're not watching the talking dog. Good for your mom. But yeah, animation, that was a very interesting era, that animation domination era. It really felt like they were really pushing hard to like rebrand like that whole
Yeah.
lineup because I think they could tell that they were like losing people, a little bit. So they're like, no, this is bold. This is big what we're doing. And in reality, it was just not, I feel like it's just that steady decline ever since. But I still love those yellow guys. I still love the little yellow Simpson family. You said you haven't been watching as much the new stuff.
I have not. I would love to. I want to see what they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I put on an episode a couple of years ago, and they had cell phones, and I was like, oh no, and I like changed it because I couldn't handle it.
That's fair. I think in one episode, like Homer has an iPad or something like that, which is really strange. Really fucked
Yeah,
up.
Homer hath iPad. But yeah, so and my friend Brothy is writing on it this season, so I
Okay.
definitely want to see it.
Shout out.
Shout out Brothy. We worked on speeches together. But yeah, so I'm going to check it out. I don't know if I'm going to love what I see, because as Southwark says, Simpsons has already done everything.
They kind of
But
have. They feel like they're in
yeah.
sort of this like snake eating its tail sort of situation where it's like they're never going to tell us not to keep making episodes, I feel like, at this point. So we just have to do everything, even if we don't want to. Like we have to just keep doing this insane shit. But I haven't been watching this season either. I think the latest episode I've checked out of The Simpsons was like maybe last season or the season before, and I was just like, it doesn't really feel like what I remember. It feels like a different show almost in some
Yeah.
ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, a little scared.
But at least we have this play, am I
Yes,
right?
bro. Yes, bro. At least we have this play. Last question before we sort of dive into the play itself and really get into this and really crack open a cold one with you and me. What makes a compelling adaptation across
Ooh.
mediums, just even outside of the context of Mr. Burns? What do you think makes a compelling adaptation? Because we're about to talk about a very multi-layered adaptation, lots of sort of hats being shuffled around here. What do you think makes an adaptation compelling across mediums?
Good question. I think that okay, I was thinking of different adaptations, and then I was like, oh yes, She's the Man, which is an adaptation of Twelfth Night, and then I
Right.
started laughing thinking about Amanda Bynes because she's hilarious, and I think under conservatorship, so we gotta get her out of there.
Is she having a Britney situation happen?
I think so. I gotta look into it. Don't quote me on that podcast.
Okay.
But anyway, what do I think makes a good adaptation? I think that the writers have to understand the themes, right, of the
Sure.
original, and then just recontextualize it to get someone else to open their mouth for the airplane to come in. You know what I mean? Like, I think
Sure.
a good adaptation is something that's like understands the core of it, but doesn't just try to regurgitate it. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's it. I think at the end of the day, it's like, how do we make this feel new? How do we make this feel fresh while still retaining what worked about the old one? And I'm thinking of like, there's this movie that was made in the 50s. Are you familiar with The Wages of Fear? Have you ever heard of The Wages of Fear?
No, I haven't.
It was this movie that came out in the 50s. I've only seen like the beginning of it, but it was a French film, a very suspenseful like thriller that was made by, I think his name was Henri Clouzot or something like that. And it's about these guys taking these trucks through the desert or not through the desert, excuse me, through like the jungle or whatever, and they have like explosives in the back, and basically if they like make one small mistake, they're gonna blow up, like in these trucks or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 50s movie, so you know, it's a lot of talking at the beginning. They don't really get to the thing that you want to see until later, which is the fucking trucks, like driving through the like Amazon or whatever, or through these jungles. But they remade the movie in the 70s, William Friedkin did, to a movie called Sorcerer. And that movie is the same exact concept. Have these people drive these trucks through a very dangerous terrain. But the filmmaking is so gnarly and so gritty and so intense and almost like pseudo-documentary, almost like feeling at times, that that kind of itself makes it feel brand new. Like, it doesn't really feel like the 50s version or whatever. So to me, like, that's obviously like a like very like, you know, they have a camera or whatever, they can do that in movies. But I'm also thinking about like, I used to, okay, secret time, I used to be a theater kid, okay? Used to be a little bit of a theater guy. Here we go, spilling his guts to everyone listening now. big fucking surprise. But I remember we used to go to the Ashland Shakespeare Festival in Southern Oregon, like once a year or whatever. This, at least nationally renowned thing. Maybe it's an international thing, but I know people like come out from out of state to go see this like festival or whatever. And I remember we were watching, I think it was Taming of the Shrew, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But they like basically made it like a reality show almost, I remember. Like it was like, they like, it was like Kardashians-esque. And I remember at one point, literally, they said, I got 99 problems, but a ship ain't one. Like they literally said that during the production. And I was like, who fucking cares about this? Like, who wants to see that? Like, that's so insane. So I think that like, I think about that too, of like, you can just set something in a different environment and have it be the same thing and it like not work because it's like dumb and like not working. Have you ever seen like a really just insane adaptation in that way?
Oh my God. So you just reminded me of, I was assistant director my junior year on The Crucible at my high school.
Yeah. Okay, sure.
And assistant director, I was just like way too self-conscious to be on stage.
Okay.
And so I like, but I wanted to like hang out with my friends. So that's absolutely how I did that.
Yeah.
But I didn't like, they didn't let me direct anything in that play. because I remember thinking how fucking stupid it was. The director at the time, very nice, cool teacher, but he had all of the, none of the dialogue was changed. Like everything, we went by the book, right? But, and even like set, it was like a black box theater. There wasn't much of a set.
Sure.
Costuming was still like old school and everything. But literally, what's his name? Proctor, whatever.
John Proctor. Yeah.
He would sit with his laptop when he was like waiting for people to come in. So it's so literally insane. Like, you know, Jerry has iPad. Like he had a laptop. And it like, yeah, it was just the dumbest prop, I thought. And we would perform the show for, I think, like, sophomores read that play.
Okay.
And the sophomores would come see it, like, and we did it a couple times for them. And literally every time there was a Q&A after, the first question was like, why do you have a laptop?
Good question. Very good question. What did they say? What was the explanation for having a laptop on stage?
He was trying to say that it's like a timeless story, but it was like, well, you didn't accomplish that because everyone's just like weirded out by the laptop with no context.
That's so distracting, dude. That's so like,
yeah.
Like, oh, that's the only thing I'm going to be thinking about the rest of the play is, why did this motherfucker have a laptop in the fucking 1600s? Is he going on Craigslist to see who's going to burn people? Like, what the fuck is he doing? Stupid, man. That, I don't like that play very much, to be honest with you. I think it's kind of dumb. What do you think?
Yeah. I'm not a fan. The other play that I assistant directed was Waiting for Godot.
Okay. That's
and
fun.
That one was actually fun, and I got to direct some scenes.
Nice. Because
it was a different director who let me do some stuff. But, I was sick of The Crucible. I thought it was so boring.
Did you have to read Death of a Salesman in high school? Was that required reading for you?
You know, it was, and then I switched teachers, so then I got out of it.
It's actually good, I think.
Okay.
I actually really like it. It was one of the only required readings I think throughout my entire life that I actually was like, that was cool. That and The Outsiders were like the only two books that were, and To Kill a Mockingbird, those three were the only required readings where I was like, that's dope.
You know what that was for me?
What?
My favorite book. Maybe we can talk about it sometime.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I got assigned Catch 22, and I love that book.
Okay. I've never read it.
Oh, it's so funny. It's so funny.
Okay. Was the like adaptation of the miniseries, did you watch that? Did that hold a candle to anything?
I didn't try it. I should. It should be on my list, but I didn't try it. But yeah, I remember we got assigned it, and then I was like sick for a couple days, and I just finished the book because I thought it was so good.
Hell yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Reading rules.
Do you actually have like a like positive relationship with reading, like even outside of like an academic sense? Like, were you like always had your head in a book like growing up? Were you always like reading something? Like, what was your relationship to reading just over the course of your life?
I'm not like a prolific reader, and I should do more. I bought a play a couple months ago because I was like, I should get back into reading.
Totally.
And that's an easy way to get my foot in. I'm going to send you what it was. I can't think of it. But so the answer is like, yes. And I read really fast.
You do?
I'm a fast reader.
Okay.
But it's really hard for me to don't judge a book by its cover thing.
Sure.
All books look really bad to me. I read the back and I'm like, nah, see, I already know what this is going to be. And it's no, you don't. Just fucking read it, you idiot. But it's really, really hard for me to commit to a book.
That's fair.
Even though when I read them, I usually like them. So
I feel like I'm the same way, but in the like almost inverse, because I'm an extremely slow reader. Mm-hmm. And I can tell even when I was reading Mr. Burns that there would be sections where I'm like, you didn't read that. You just looked at it and you just like tried to just like through osmosis, like learn like what was going on, like in the story, but you didn't actually like read that. And that was always, I think that's unfortunately like maybe crazy Noah's opinion over here, but I think that's like a symptom of like public school and just like having to like get through shit, you know, where it's like, damn, I got so much to read that I'm like not really going to like spend the time to like really read this. I'm just going to sort of understand the gist of what's going on and then move on because I don't want to be reading this. I'm going to be quizzed on it. I think reading comprehension quizzes are like the biggest crock of shit in the entire world. Sorry.
Well, yeah. And we had Spark Notes at our fingertips.
Totally. 100%.
That's mostly why I didn't read the shit I was assigned in school. Because I was sick, and that's why I was so bored that I read that my favorite book.
Sure, that's fair.
That time I got assigned, because I was like, okay, I got nothing to do but be sick in bed and read this book. Usually I just did Spark Notes.
Yeah, why spend the time reading in that sense when you're like, I know I'm just going to be quizzed on this shit. That's the whole reason they're having me read it. And then at the end, I'm supposed to present about it. I'm going to use Spark Notes for that shit too, you know? I remember we had to read the Iliad first class. Have you ever even thought once in your life, maybe I'll check out the Iliad?
I can't get into the classics.
It's so stupid, Jackie. It's so stupid. There's literally a section in the Iliad where he's just naming ships. It's just like 50,000 ships just like on like a 10 like page span. And my teacher literally like the first day was like, who read the ships section of the Iliad? And like a couple kid raised their hand. They're like, you shouldn't have read that. You just should have skipped that. It's like, why didn't you tell us that, you piece of shit?
99 ships. I was trying to do something there, but I couldn't.
I got 99 problems and 10 pages of ships are one. How about that? We'll go there. I think we nailed the question about what makes a compelling adaptation. I think we got far away.
I thought of another good one though.
Yeah, what's up?
I haven't seen it since it came out, but did you see Creed?
Yes.
I think that is a good adaptation.
Agreed.
Do you agree with it? Cool.
I do.
And I think it's because, what's his name?
Ryan Coogler.
He talked, I don't know if you saw this interview, but he was talking about how his dad, he never saw him cry except for watching Rocky.
Oh, shit.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, okay, you get it. You get what Rocky's about.
Yeah.
And it makes grown men cry. So that's what he's going to try to do in his adaptation.
And it's...
Well, kind of sequel, whatever that is.
Yeah, whatever you call that, I guess. It is a sequel, but it's also, like, a whole its own little thing. And, like, putting it outside of Rocky and just making it about that character, but giving mm-hmm. that character the same treatment that you would have given the original Rocky. It's so smart to be like, okay, this was your arch rival's kid. Now the guy that you know, Rocky, has to mentor this new kid, you know? It's
and you
it's
still got smart. The love story.
Yes. Is that what is that Tessa Thompson? Who is that?
Yeah.
She's great.
Mm-hmm.
We love her.
Great
for that.
Adaptation.
We love it. That's fun. We love it for us. I'm going to give some quick fast facts about Mr. Burns of Post-Electric Play, but then I want to talk about the damn show. I want to talk about the damn play. Can we do that?
Yes, please.
Where's the clock at? How close are we to midnight?
You're getting closer, so you better hurry up.
Okay, fuck. Here we go. Mr. Burns, Post-Electric Play, is an American black comedy play written by Anne Washburn, featuring music by Michael Friedman, premiered May 2012 at the Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in Washington, D.C., and then ran from August through October of 2013 by Playwrights Horizons in New York City. The play was commissioned and developed with the New York Theater Company, The Civilians. It received polarized reviews and was nominated for the 2014 Drama League Award for Outstanding Production of a Broadway or Off-Broadway Play. I find it very interesting that it received polarized views, but I actually very much understand why it received polarized views, and we will be talking about that here very shortly. Mr. Burns, Post-Electric Play, tells the story of a group of survivors recalling and retelling Cape Fear, an episode of the TV show The Simpsons, shortly after a global catastrophe, then examines the ways the story was changed 7 years after that, and then finally 75 years after that. If for a long time, Washburn had been exploring what it would be like to, quote, take a TV show and push it past the apocalypse and see what happened to it. And for a while, she considered Friends, shout out Friends, Cheers, shout out Cheers, and MASH, shout out MASH. She ultimately settled on The Simpsons. Working with the Civilians Theater Company, who had commissioned the play, Washburn held a workshop for a week in a bank vault beneath Wall Street, which was being used as a shared rehearsal space in 2008 to see how much of any episode of The Simpsons the actors had assembled, including Matthew Mayer, Maria Dizia, and Jennifer R. Morris, could remember. There's more to that little thing, but let's just stop and think about that. She gathered actors underneath Wall Street. There is somewhere but underneath Wall Street where Broadway people have access to, just willy-nilly. And they're doing their best to remember an episode of The Simpsons. That is literally insane to me to try and do that. Would you do that if you really wanted to, like, crack that nut? Jackie, is that too insane to you?
No, like, I miss the idea of, like, collaborating with friends and just being like, let's try this bit out and see if it goes somewhere.
Sure.
Like, that is ultimate goal for me.
Yeah, to be able to just... paid to do that.
Yeah, hell yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. To just get paid to fuck around and be like, what if I put my whole arm in my pants and just walked around like that? Is that gonna do anything for us? And people are like, yeah, that works, that's good. Yeah, okay, write that down. We're gonna do that. Marr knew The Simpsons well, and the group decided on the episode 1990 from 1993, Cape Fear, based on the 1991 film Cape Fear, itself a remake of the eponymous 1962 film, which is based on the 1957 novel, The Executioners. He helped Dizia and Morris remember the episode. Then the two of them went on to perform it for an audience without his help. Washburn subsequently utilized recordings of this process in writing her play's first act, which we will talk about here very shortly. Julie Grossman examined Mr. Burns as an instance of a multi-layered adaptation. She wrote that the show, quote, challenges audiences to embrace the imaginative, if not strange and alienating, scions, adaptations of cultural matter. What do you think about that quote from Ms. Grossman? It says, challenges audiences to embrace the imaginative, if not strange and alienating, scions or adaptations of cultural matter. That there's a lot going on in that phrase.
Yeah. Again, reading comprehension, not
yeah, getting quizzed. Sucks.
Wait, okay, say the last four words again.
Yes, absolutely.
Just the last four.
Adaptations of cultural matter.
Cultural
Those are literally
matter.
The last four.
Does matter mean like an object, or does it mean like things that matter?
That's a great question. It doesn't specify, but I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to make the executive decision that it's like things you can hold, like the matter yeah. of the earth.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Mr. Burns, because it's so layered, which, by the way, I read that Anne Washburn was like, oh, it actually worked out pretty nicely that we chose The Simpsons, and specifically this Cape Fear episode. Like, it wasn't even in her game plan of being like, look at all these layers of adaptation that I have.
Damn, like, that is a little serendipitous little moment for Anne right there, just being like, yeah there's like a five layers of adaptation happening here from the play to The Simpsons to the actual fucking source material that Simpsons episode's based on. Crazy.
Yeah, so wild. What were we talking about?
Doesn't matter. I was just asking you what you thought of this Julie Grossman quote about it being it challenging audiences to embrace cultural matter. I don't know what the fuck it means. I'm genuinely asking, what do you think is going on here? I don't know what the fuck. That's like one of those things that like the teacher writes up on the board and goes, spend 10 minutes writing about that. And me just coming back and her knowing that she's going to call on me, be like, Noah, what did you write down? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what you even want me to say right there. And you're 1,000 times smarter than I am. And so that's why I'm asking you, what does it mean? What is going on with that quote?
See, I don't know either. I think that it talks about being, you mentioned that it's polarizing, right?
Yes.
So it's asking audiences a lot to buy into this reality that is, I would say the first act is grounded in reality a
sure.
little bit, pretty grounded. But then from there, it kind of like spirals out of control. And I love blending reality with the absurd.
Yes.
And I think Anne Washburn does a great job of doing that in Mr. Burns. But yeah, I don't know what that person's quote meant. Sorry.
Yeah, she's freaking out, dude. We need to find Julie Grossman and sit her down and be like, you need to settle down. You need to fucking settle down with what you write. Speaking of Anne Washburn, she's an American playwright. She graduated from Reed College in Portland, Oregon. Shout out Reed College Woo-hoo. In Portland, Oregon. Woo, thank you. Wow. Reed College. Everyone's freaking out in the stands. Reed College standing up, giving a standing ovation to Reed College. In undergrad and then New York University with her MFA. Her plays have been produced in New York City by Cherry Lane Theater, Club Thumb, The Civilians, Vineyard Theater, Dixon Place, and Soho Repertory Theater. The moment you've all been waiting for, folks, we will actually talk about the play now. Jackie, I want to break this down by acts because they're all very different and all very specific. Briefly, what is going on in this first act? If someone did not know what this was, very briefly, what happens in the first act, more or less?
Sure. There are people gathered around a campfire. There's like five of them or something. And they're trying to recount the Simpsons episode, the Cape Fear episode, which is season 5, episode 2.
Yes.
And yeah, they're just trying to remember what came first. Like someone will say, oh yeah, there was pen pals. And they're like, oh no, wait, first they were watching Itchy and Scratchy. And then, so yeah, it's just them kind of recounting this episode. And then when they hear a noise, they're all pretty quick to jump to their guns because they're scared of who it could be.
Sure.
So then you get the reality of like, oh, this isn't like fun campfire games. Like these people are in hiding.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a pretty good summary.
That's pretty good. And then these people come up and they're like trying to basically suss out each other for the rest of the mm-hmm. act, right? More or less like, mm-hmm. are you dangerous? More mm-hmm. or less. It's a very sharp tone break. Like,
yeah,
you're right. We think that it's fun and games to remember this Simpsons episode as best we can, and then it's like, no, this is all these people have is remembering this episode. It's really scary, actually.
Yeah, and I will say the play is a very good read for a pandemic.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it feels... this is the first time I was visiting it during the pandemic and being like, oh, yeah, this I understand these feelings of fear and the feeling to seek meaningless entertainment, right? Like, we're just trying to just distract ourselves.
100%. That's a great point, is that it's during these last, what will soon be 2 years, crazy to say that number, but where it had been these last somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, it's just like, oh no, we kind of went through this as a society, and not to be, you know, the weird guy who's like, hey, maybe it's about to get a lot worse this coming winter, and maybe we're about to not have a lot of fun for these next couple months coming up. But all to say, it felt, I have to imagine seeing this in 2016, where that's not even something on your mind, versus now it's like, hits different, so to speak.
Yeah. As great philosophers once said, hits different.
As Plato said to Aristotle, sure hits different, babe. Sure hits different, baby. Jackie, what do you like about the first act, and why does it work for you?
The first act works for me. I think the dialogue is pretty sharp. I think it's, like I said, like really grounded, and it feels authentic and kind of people like remembering things and talking over each other a little bit. But then that tone shift is like pretty chilling.
Yes.
It's like realizing like, oh, these people are in danger, something's up. And then you learn that, like the grid is down, right? And you're like, okay, whatever that means, or we know what that means, but like, why? And then you learn like power plant shit and like nuclear shit going
right
on. And the first act really works for me because it's just like people seeking any sense of normalcy that they can, even if it's just laughing about a specific moment in an episode,
right?
And that is why I was like cheering after I saw this, being like, yeah, I'm gonna go write TV and write jokes that people remember, and yes, like I don't need to give anything else back to society because I'm gonna give my humor.
Yes.
Because that's, yeah, I think so. That's why act one works for me really well. It's just like this juxtaposition of like people trying to laugh like they did as a kid watching a cartoon while they're in pretty scary times.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. And I think that feeling specifically, at least personally, was my feeling during, I'm going to say, the first 4 to 6 months of the pandemic last year. Was just like, it was like, okay, you first think like, maybe I'll have all this time to like check out this shit I've never seen before, you know, since we're all going to be at home and spending so much more time at home. And it's like, nope, I'm watching The Simpsons. I literally was watching The Simpsons so much during the beginning of quarantine back in, you know, 2020 or whatever, because I was like, this just feels good. This just reminds me of a time. You know, it's nostalgic, but it's like nostalgia ultra almost, where it's like, man, remember when we didn't have to stay inside for fear of getting sick? You know, like just walking outside and possibly getting this thing that we can't like figure out yet, like what the hell's going on? Yeah. It was like nostalgia ultra, not to be, you know, a Frank Ocean guy over here and, you know, say nostalgia ultra, but like it was crazy. So I legitimately was like, fuck, this nails the tone of the first 4 to 6 months of the pandemic, at least in my eyes, so well. And it was The Simpsons that was kind of keeping me sane for a little bit, weirdly enough. Is there anything specifically worth mentioning about Act One? Oh, I have a question for you actually about end of Act One.
Yeah.
I know it's gonna come up later and maybe that's why they set it up here, but what do you think is the deal with the whole Mikado thing at the end of the first act? I didn't really fully understand that, except where maybe when it comes up later, but what do you, is there any significance to that, you think?
Remind me, tell me what you're talking about.
It's like at the very end of the first act, and one of the guys, I can't remember which character it is, maybe it's Matt, who's like doing the like three little girls from school today whatever. What's up with that? Why do they do that at the end?
It's in, I think Sideshow Bob sings that in the episode.
Oh, does he? Okay.
I think so, and that's why they start singing it. Because, yeah, they're trying to remember what he was singing, and then one guy's like, "Don't make me sing." You know, he's like,
Yes.
"I can do it." Yeah, it's in the episode because Sideshow Bob is. Oh my God, can we talk about Sideshow Bob for a second?
Let's do
One of
it.
the funniest characters of all time.
Yes. Yes,
Oh my
bro.
God.
Go
And
in.
like, you know, I mean, this is like not depth of my Simpsons knowledge, but like, they literally were like, "Okay, let's do Frasier if he was like mentally insane trying to kill people."
Hell yeah.
Like it was truly like, and then they happened to get Kelsey Grammer to sign on. And he was like, "Fine, I'll do it." But that character was written to be if Frasier was trying
Wow.
to kill people. Yeah.
Well, they nailed the casting, is what I will say. They nailed it. It doesn't come up until later, but the rake bit from
Yes.
this episode, it
Yes.
might, is that the funniest thing that's ever happened in
Oh my
TV?
God, so funny. And one time, in my wheelchair, I actually like rolled over a broom and it hit me in the face.
Okay,
That was at my
classic.
next internship after the radio station,
They
the
said,
next one.
"Okay, you've already spooked the biggest Jewish reggae rapper in the face of the earth. This is payback for that." And then just bonk. Did you roll back over it and then do it again like Sideshow Bob style, or was it just, I know I've learned from experience here?
It was just the one and done, but I just had to throw that in there that I have had it happen to me where I got bonked in the face by a broom.
Classic. I'm glad you've had that experience.
Thank you. Where are you talking? Sideshow Bob. Oh yeah, because he's a freako and he sings all those like old, what are
Yes.
they, like Gibson something musicals, the HMS
It's
Pinafore maybe.
yeah, and the Mikado was, it's whatever, it's that movie Topsy Turvy. Gilbert and Sullivan. Gilbert and Sullivan. Yes. Really scary guy. Kind of a freak. A little bit of a freak guy. He is so scary and so funny, and yet, like, it's just weird thinking about, like, when you read that or when you saw that for the first time, were you like, oh yeah, I guess like that is like sort of what happens, and like that like idea of like trying to remember an episode, like, did that like spark anything in you? Or like, I've been there just like trying to like recall details of something like with friends or whatever. It's kind of like a maddening feeling, but there's a lot of comedy to be mined from that. I feel like it's a very interesting way to like start a piece, you know?
We've all been there, right? We've all like been trying to remember something, and I'm even like, I'll usually just Google it, right? But
Sure.
sometimes I really want to test myself and like
Sure.
I just won't do it. Or I'll try to be remembering a song and you can't like just hum the song into
Sure.
Google. I think they're working on that though. But yeah, I think it's just a very grounded way to start, and then it's just gonna get weirder and weirder from there.
Oh, okay, folks. It's gonna get a little weird, so go ahead and just strap in right now because we're about to get a little freaky with it.
Oh
Can
wait,
we?
I have one more thing in Act
Yes.
One.
What's up?
So there's a point where they meet a new person, and then they all go, "Okay, that's 10 names, right?" And then they name 10 people that they're looking for in this like
Oh,
post-apocalypse
right.
world. And that was another moment being like, "Oh shit." Like these people are separated from their loved ones, and
Yeah.
they're trying to see if this person who they ran into has met them or crossed paths with them. And I read that Anne Washburn got that idea because it's like, okay, if we're in this post-apocalypse world, there's going to be some kind of like order of like how we're trying to find people, right? And
Sure.
do things. Because she was in New York City for 9/11, and she
Oh.
said like right away there was like po posters up for like missing people. And then it got to the point where there was like so many posters for missing people that it was like at that point just like a memorial kind of thing where it's
Oh my
like,
God.
yeah. And I was like, whoa, okay. So
Yeah.
there's your little trivia nugget.
That is some little trivia nugget, bro. That's wild as hell. It is there when you read that, it does like they really, it feels like even if they legit, like page-wise aren't actually laboring on it, it feels like they're really making it a point to be like, you know, H. Nelson, like 60 years old or whatever. Like they're really trying to make this like feel like, you know, you never meet these characters, but they are real people who are genuinely possibly dead, definitely missing. And it is, like you said, that tone shift is chilling. It is remarkable. It is scary to, like, go from, like, oh, we're palling around, like, oh, it's a, like a fun night or whatever, to, oh, no, this is a life or death situation. And it does, and it happens very organically, too, which I think is very interesting and very well done.
Yeah.
Yes, Chef.
Kudos, Anne Washburn.
Thank you, Anne Washburn. Speaking of Anne Washburn, let's talk about the second act of Mr. Burns' post-lecture play. Yes. Thank you. Second act, briefly, what's going on in the second act of this?
The second act, it's 7 years later, and we got the same people, maybe like a couple extra new people, and they are now a traveling theater troupe that performs Simpson episodes. So we're seeing the like tech backstage, them getting ready for it to perform an episode, and they also perform commercials. So they're practicing commercials, and they do like chart hits. They like do a medley of popular songs.
Right.
So yeah, it's kind of like, you know, as Noah, former theater kid, would understand. it's a dress rehearsal, and they're
working the kinks out. What do you like about this second act, and what works for you? Why do you think this second act works?
I think the second act works because it's like, oh, of course, yeah, of course, in a post-electric society, we're going to be performing TV shows, specifically popular TV shows. Sure. Like, yeah, that makes total sense. But it's also like, I never thought of that before. So sure. I was just like, oh, this is nice. This is good little premise. And then if you get to like the dread of it, which I think I understand now more in a pandemic, is like, oh, these people are clinging to any sense of normalcy.
Yep.
These people are, we don't even like commercials, right? Like I get mad at most commercials, and they're like striving to present commercials that people are going to remember and have nostalgia for.
Oh, true. Like, that's a great point.
So chilling to me that, and I think that's where we are at in like, we're in act two of pandemic, of being like, yep, we're all good now. We're all good and we're gonna put on our commercial.
We're just, you know, it doesn't matter that things are spiking in every which way. We're just gonna go eat at Red Robin right now and we're gonna have a great time at Red Robin. It's fine.
Yeah.
You're 100% right. It is a little bit of like selective ignorance, a little bit in that regard, you know, in terms of what's happening right now. And that's a great point. I didn't even think about the fact that like it's the commercials that they really need to get right, because the way in which the writing is presented to us, you are playing catch up the entire time, I think, in terms of like she's ahead of you in terms of like just putting you in the middle of the action, and you're slowly like putting the pieces together, you know, other than the fact that it's 7 years in the future and the fact that it was, you know, we're at this campsite or whatever in the first act. She's always giving you breadcrumbs so that you can put together the full severity and the full stakes of everything, but she's doing it very intentionally, and it's almost maddening a little bit, like, when you're reading it, to be like, wait a minute, what the fuck is happening right now? Like, it feels so normal what's happening right now, but it feels so weird at the same time. You know, like, that was my biggest takeaway from this act, is like, this is like hurting my brain a little bit to read because it's so weird, but they're treating it with such normalcy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really good point. And I think, I'm coming off of having seen it 3 times.
Sure.
And this is the second time I've read it, where I just like, I'm like going along, I'm like catching, oh, all these little nuances, so clever, so good. But you're right. Like Anne Washburn like is putting you in the thick of it. She's not giving you even all the context of what happened to make it this post-electric society. But I think that I really, if it's a play, if it's a movie, TV, I really like when my hand isn't being held to understand things.
Totally.
That is like maybe my number one thing for comedy, drama. Like, I want to like figure it out myself.
Sure. Yeah, that hand-holding thing is like, It's like they're telling you that they don't trust you, you know, yeah. to like piece everything together. And at that point, it's a little bit like off-putting. It's like, bro.
Yeah, it's like they're spitting in my face. You know?
They're doing the little hand motion is like that, like our Italian friends like to do, or the Italian caricatures that we've seen on The Simpsons like to do, where there's, you know, fucking moving forward with the hand. But yeah, it is like, dude, leave me alone. I got this. Like, I'm going to figure this out. It's fine. Unless it sucks. Like, unless what I'm watching sucks, then I'm like, what was that? Like, why did I bother with that? But like, if it's good, it's like, leave me alone. Let me figure this out. It's cool.
But yeah, it is. Hard to keep up, I think, sometimes. And usually you're like, okay, now I'm starting to understand. Like, I think one pretty creepy thing in this act is when they talk about buying lines from fans.
Oh, yeah.
Did you catch this thing? So it's like, yeah, they don't remember all of these episodes, right? That their traveling troupe, like, bought somehow.
Right.
I think they, like, different troops have to fight over which episodes they get to do.
That seems like what it's going on, yeah.
Yeah, and that they don't remember all these lines, so that when they travel to a new city, they let people come up to them and be like, hey, I remember this line from Cape Fear.
Right.
Like, oh, I'll stay away, all right? I'll stay away forever. And if you give them a line and they agree, like, that was, yeah, you're right, that was in the episode, then they pay them for the line.
Yeah.
And then this act talks about how it's starting to get out of control because people are saying, like, hey, you used a line that I gave you and you didn't pay me. And they're starting to get a little violent.
Yes.
And I was like, damn, like, we have anything good.
Yeah, exactly. We can't remember the thing we're supposed to be doing that's supposed to, like, put food on the table and clothes on our backs. We have to buy these lines from the peanut gallery, you know, like, we got to, like, swim throughout this, like, audience to figure out, like, what the hell we're, like, doing in the first place. It's so dystopian in a way that, like, we've never really seen before, you know, and as a first-time reader and really as a first-time person swimming through this, I'm just soaking it all in. I'm just trying to, like, stay with, you know, the author on this and be like, okay, like, let's just keep trucking along. Like, let's keep trucking along. Like, let's see what's happening. Cause it's so much information, you know,
once,
but it's really unsettling in, like, a very, like, banal way, you know, like, it makes the banal very creepy. And I thought that was very cool of Anne Washburn.
Yeah. She's good at that. Making it creepy.
She's pretty good. She's fine. She's fine to me. What else do you like about this act, Jackie? What do you think? What else would you like? What works?
Well, this is when, like, seeing it performed really matters, because I think the sets that they do are awesome and the costuming, because it's all, like, found materials that they turn into, like, Marge's hair will be, like, you know, the blue IKEA bag will be, like, Marge's hair. So it's all, like, recycled materials that they make costumes for them to look like The Simpsons.
Wow.
Yeah.
That uncanny valley-ness of, like, oh, it kind of looks like something I know, but it looks like the weird version of it.
Yeah, exactly. So that is really great. And the medley, which you didn't get in the book or in the play, at least my version, is, like, the top charts. They have, like, Toxic by Britney Spears.
Okay, let's go. Yes, we love Britney.
And then they have, like, I think Anne Washburn said she asked the actors that she was, like, you know, collaborating with on making this play. Like, they're like, what do you think the songs are of this last, like, 10 years? So they said, like, Who Let the Dogs Out and Bad Romance and Single Ladies and Lose Yourself, right? So they gave, like, a list, and then she worked with the composer or whatever to make the medley for them to, like, sing as a commercial. So it's all these, like, snippets of these songs together.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really impressive.
Yeah, if anything, reading this play made me realize I have to see this performed, you know, like, as soon as possible. Cause I feel like I only got, like, a tenth of, like, what this thing can really do, you know? And so I'm like, yeah, this is, I, like, whenever it's coming through LA or if ever I'm in a place where I can see this, you know, maybe I'll go to Chicago and hang out with Mason. So just so I can see it. Maybe I'll be like, Mason, I'm coming to see you again, but it's only so that we can go see Mr. Burns' A Post-Electric play, you son of a bitch. Let me see. Did I have anything else? No, I think that we kind of covered it, I feel like. Is there anything else you want to make sure we know about Act 2 before we dive into Act 3?
Yes, there is. Okay. There's a really good line that I'm trying to pull up in Act 2. Because, honestly, I think we shouldn't talk much about Act 3.
Really?
You know what I mean?
Okay. Let's not talk much about Act 3.
Hold on. Yes. This is a line from Act 2. And meaning is everywhere. We get meaning for free whether we like it or not. Meaningless entertainment, on the other hand, is really hard.
Say that. You got to read that. This is your version of the Julie Grossman quote. Say that one more time.
I'll do it again.
Thank you.
Meaning is everywhere. We get meaning for free, whether we like it or not. Meaningless entertainment, on the other hand, is really hard.
Damn. And that's in Act 2 of the play that we're talking about today. They say that? What the hell? Yeah. That's crazy.
Because they're arguing over like motivation, and one of them is like, we're the Simpsons. Like, we're just trying to entertain people. We're not trying to make this like grounded, whatever you want to say, like this Shakespearean, right? We're just trying to entertain people because that's what we need right now.
Sure.
And so, yeah, if talk about like distracting ourselves, or like, I'm a huge proponent of like, I like highbrow shit, which I guess you could say is this play, maybe.
Right.
But I also like lowbrow stuff of like, I'll watch Vanderpump Rules.
Let's go. Both can coexist together.
Yeah. And I think that this play is talking about why we need the lowbrow stuff and how that transcends time.
That's a great point. Yeah. Because The Simpsons is also sort of like a walking dichotomy of that. Because totally. It is the, you know, the Homer getting, you know, saying, pickles or donut or whatever. But it's also like some of the cleverest, most timeless comedy of the last however many years. You know, it's both those things at the same time. And that's why it's the prime shit has endured, you know, for all these years, is because it's the same reason I honestly, and maybe we're veering into some dangerous territory with me about to say what I'm about to say. They were about to go off road a little bit. Jackie, strap in. It's the reason why I think Conan O'Brien actually has been able to endure maybe a little bit longer than some of his contemporaries, is because his humor is so based in like the silly and the like ridiculous, but it's done in such a smart and sharp and observant way that I feel like I could watch old Conan stuff, you know, sans the 90s and early 2000s sort of like swagger and sheen that's over everything. Mm-hmm. And I can watch those bits and some of Letterman's like, you know, like remote stuff. And it just endures over like whatever the fuck is happening now, you know, and fucking James Corden dancing in the street as a rat, you know, which will endure over the next 150 years. Like, they're going to be screening that in theaters in front of movies or whatever it is in the future. But it's that walking dichotomy of, you know, cleverness and sharp, you know, observations and, you know, timeless humor with, I'm going to hit this guy over the head because that's always going to be funny.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, scratch the itch that's going to make you laugh like a little kid again. And then don't treat me like a baby. Like, give me something substantial to munch on.
And that's why we like Mr. Burns' A Post-Electric Play by Anne Washburn.
Yeah, that's why I like it. That's kind of a central theme, I think.
I know you said you didn't want to talk much about Act 3, but can we talk about it a little bit?
We can talk about it a little bit.
Okay, I'm going to let you decide how much we can talk about it. I'm going to ask questions. You give me as much info as you're willing to divulge.
I think we can talk about it as long as we have a little disclaimer right now that says, if you really want to see this play without knowing what happens in Act 3, then stop listening.
Stop listening, but also skip to the end so that you can hear the fun stuff that we say at the very end of the show.
Yeah, skip to the end. That's what I meant to say. Skip to the end.
Yeah, stop listening to this show forever, but also just skip to the end. Let's talk about Act 3. Jackie, the third act of this play is so fucked up. What is going on? Briefly.
Yeah, so Act 3 is 75 years later, and it's basically an opera
Yes.
of, yeah, it's an opera. It was really hard to read, like, to know what was going on.
100% agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's basically the same episode, how it was remembered 75 years later, in which, like, Mr. Burns is now the villain instead of Sideshow Bob.
Right.
And it still has a couple pieces in there that are accurate, but the rest is kind of this, like, mangled mesh of, like, telephone, right? Of, like, how this story traveled over time.
It made me think of, quite literally, they're going to be thinking about The Simpsons in 100, 200, 300 years, the way that we think about Shakespeare now, the way that we think about the Iliad that my dumbass teacher made me read in high school. But it's the same shit. And especially because of the fact that in this universe, everything has to be passed down orally, it really does feel like Greek tragedy stuff because all that shit was said, you know, it was passed down between the playwrights. Very little of that shit was written down. So it really is that oral tradition of like this person heard this episode from this person and then they had to put it on. It really does, like you said, that has that feeling of the telephone game. It has that feeling of, wow, this is not your dad's, this is not your grandpa's Simpsons, you know? This is epic. This is like insane. You know, it is the same way we treat Hamlet, the same way we treat Romeo and Juliet in a modern day. It was really shocking to read. And it is hard to fully understand what's going on because I'm sure the lighting and the stage direction and the costumes and sets make this feel like not even the same show ultimately.
No, it, and I don't know if you picked up on it, but they do have basically a Greek chorus,
Yes.
like singing throughout. And it, like, yeah, the third act is a musical. It is a whole set to music. It is
Yes.
people singing. And that's why, even when I saw, like, high schools are doing this, I was like, what the f-? Like, they have to have so much range of, like, being able to do this, like, grounded act one, and then act two they're already singing, and three they're doing, like, an opera.
Yeah,
Like, I'm like, how are these children doing this?
Act one is like a very grounded like survivalist tale. Act two is like some weird like theater of the absurd shit. And act three is literally like an aria. Like it's crazy. It's fucked up, actually. It's actually fucked up. So
It's fucked up. But yeah, and they have, like, yeah, it's amazing, and how much is intertwined, and it's like they have lines from the chart hits medley. Like, there's some Eminem "Lose Yourself" lines in
Yes.
this opera, and they're,
Yes.
because it's all jumbled together, and it's all like, you know, what are you doing? You're doing a podcast, which is oral storytelling, and that's what Anne Washburn is saying, that it really matters, and what will keep us grounded in society is
Yes.
sharing our stories.
I'm sending this to Anne Washburn and saying, adapt this, you son of a bitch. Adapt this to the stage. Me and Jackie's conversation. She's going to change so much. There's going to be like five people on the pod, and they're not going to be talking about her play. We're going to be talking about like fucking Moby Dick or something, and it'll be the same type of thing. What is this like seeing this happen live? If you can try to explain the
It's
feelings,
scary.
is it?
It's scary. Yeah, like, Itchy and Scratchy come on, and they're like, they're not only, like, tying up the Simpsons family and, like, literally, like, terrorizing them, and, like, one, like, I remember seeing one was, like, humping Lisa and, like, really uncomfortable. Like, it is
Holy
a
shit.
scary. It is scary. And it's like the lighting makes it very chilling. It's like, oh, they're gonna die, and we're gonna
Yeah.
watch the Simpson family die. And you know, like, I've seen the show three different productions,
Yeah.
and Bart was always played by a female in the third act,
Okay.
which also in real life Bart is played by a female.
Shout out.
So shout out Yeardley. So they. I brought that up because I guess it's just like Bart is just this, like, beautiful songbird singing,
Oh,
like,
sure.
trying to, like, stay alive And I think it's a story of like resistance, the human resilience.
Sure.
And we've been through a pandemic before. We'll get through another one. And I think that really like that's why it is 75 years later, because it's like the people who the characters who we know from Acts 1 and 2, like they're probably dead and gone.
Right.
And it's just like this is the mangled mess of what this story is now.
Yeah, I was actually wanted to make a point to ask you sort of like what are we ultimately in your mind ramping up toward, thematically and, emotionally, because reading it feels like there's a very specific message, like a very specific like aboutness of the third act, but it feels, and maybe I'm mistaken here, but it feels a little segmented from what we see in Acts 2 and Act 1. So I'm not saying it doesn't work, but I am saying it feels a little
Sure.
bit like out of left field based on what we've written before, like what we've seen before and what we've read before. But it's such a segmented show that you just kind of need these like three disparate pieces to all have happened in order to fully appreciate maybe this emotional payoff in Act 3. Does that resonate at all? Do you have any thoughts about that, what I just said?
No, I get what you're saying. I think so I've never seen an opera. I want to.
Okay.
But I think just in general, musicals are very like, and now we're gonna sing what we feel. And I
Sure.
think that's kind of what they're doing here. Like Act Two, they were busy putting up a show. They didn't have time to talk about their fears and their
Sure.
hopes and their dreams and like emotional shit. And like they also were trying to distract themselves from that, right?
Sure.
So I think like at this, it ramps up to Act Three where it's like, you know what? Like storytelling's all we got, and the story that we're gonna tell is that like you love your brother who's a pain in your ass, and you love your mom and dad who aren't, always on your side, but we gotta defeat the evil Mr. Burns. So
Sure.
that's, I don't know, that's what I take away from it. If it's like all this convoluted ramps up to the takeaway that is like The Simpsons was created to show a middle class family
Yeah.
and to show like a family that doesn't get along, right?
Sure.
And
Yeah.
it's like, but in the worst circumstances, which we kind of see in Act Three for The Simpsons, it's like Bart isn't gonna say, "Eat my shorts," you know? He's
Right.
gonna like cry because his family's being murdered in front of him.
Yeah, and that is ultimately more or less, I think, what's made The Simpsons endure in, people's hearts through the years. And you want, especially when you look at other adult animated shows, the only one that I think has a somewhat similar heart to it is King of the Hill. And I think that those
Yes.
characters have a little bit more heart, and there's a little bit less irony and a little bit more focus on characters and relationships than maybe like a South Park or a Family Guy or any other, adult animated show maybe, or even like, those classics or whatever. The Simpsons really does, these characters love each other, at the end of the
Yeah.
day. Even though they fight and even though they get along, and a lot of the times they make bad decisions, that really screw up things for people in their lives, maybe unintentionally, but they do. They still love each other, and that's
Yeah.
why we go back and we see this silly little family, is because we want to see them make up, we want to see them have a good time, we want to see them, love each other at the end of the day. And that's always beautiful. And that, you're right, that is happening at the end of Act Three here, even if it does feel segmented and desperate from what we've seen before. It's just like the natural evolution of The Simpsons in a weird way, almost. Is that fair to say?
I think it's fair. Yeah. I
Thanks.
think yeah, it's like what was I gonna say? I was gonna say it Act Three just delivers on like in The Simpsons, I think the heart sneaks up on you
Totally.
in certain episodes. And Act Three is being like, yep, we're gonna give you this thing that you told your great great grandkid was like, yeah, it was the show, and it was pretty sweet ultimately.
Right.
Even yeah,
Sure.
yeah, I think it just like was trying to pass along that it was a show about a family who loved each other, even though shit got bleak, and that's why this horrifying Greek chorus rendition of The Simpsons isn't the one that we know and love.
Damn. We love that for those guys. We love that for Bart, Lisa, Maggie, Homer, Marge. And Mr. Burns, of course, got to be the villain. That final image, reading that final image, kind of like sent just a big old shiver down my spine.
Yeah.
To see him come up and like pass out on the bike and like not be able to go any longer. Like,
yeah.
It's really emotionally cathartic, but it's also like incredibly sad, but also like inspiring at the end of the day. It's like everything wrapped up into one. What's that like seeing that on stage? Like, does he literally come up from underneath the stage and everything?
Yeah. So yeah, the actor playing Mr. Burns is on this bike and he's going as fast as he can. And the bike comes up from the stage and you realize he's powering all the lights that had turned on.
Oh, wow.
And as soon as he like passes out, it goes black.
It's crazy. Even the bad guy is trying to help you feel that emotional, you know, sweetness and that emotional core at the end of it all. And he's there for a reason. He's not just bad to be bad. He might be bad, but he looks good doing it. So
excellent.
Excellent. Yes. Jackie, is there anything else we're saying about Act 3? We've been talking for a while. I feel like we've covered our bases mostly, unless there's anything I'm not remembering.
Nah, I think we covered it. I think it's, as I said, like, go see the show if you can.
Yeah.
If you're in Chicago, go give that, you know, theater who hasn't been getting money, go give them some money. Go see a show.
Hey.
If you feel like you're up for it, go do it.
I will say, as someone who has read the show and not seen the show, there's no way to, I think, fully capture what I think the potential of this show is on paper without having seen it. And I'm trying not to watch anything. I would just like to go in blind and see this done live. And that's the kind of amazing thing I feel like for these people who do put this show on is like they're reading this script and they're like, we got to make this happen somehow. You know? Like, we got to make this shit work. And, you know, being able to translate that to the stage, that's no easy task for this show. I feel like this show's a huge undertaking in every way, you know?
Yeah, that, again, like, why are high schools doing it? It makes no sense to me.
It's because one, like, theater nerd kid who's, like, you know, like, head of, like, the Thespian Society is like, I just read Dan Washburn, Mr. Burns, and they're like, well, I guess this guy's a senior this year, we're gonna, like, let him put on the show, or, like, whatever it is, and it's a fucking disaster. But
he's got a killer Sideshow Bob impression.
Killer Sideshow Bob. Mom is, like, head of, like, the, like, PTA for, like, the theater, like, alliance for, like, you know, like, parents and the school working together, and they're like, we're gonna let this kid fucking do this shit. It sucks. We're mad at him right now. Jackie, Quinn, thank you so much for coming to the show. Thank you so much for bringing me and the audience Mr. Burns, A Post-Electric Play. This is the reason you came on the show. You get to plug anything you want to plug. Ooh. We're at that time now. I know, right? This is huge. This is, well, the whole reason everyone comes on the show. Not to talk to me, but to talk to the audience for 30 to 60 seconds about where they can find you and what you're doing. So the floor is yours. Plug away.
Follow me on Twitter. My handle is LLCoolJackie.
Yes.
That's really all I got. I already plugged Theater Wits production of Mr. Burns. So
Shout out to Theater Wits production of Mr. Burns, and shout out to @LLCoolJackie. We love to see it. I'm going to do some really shitty plugs now. Okay. So just bear with me.
I'm ready.
Thank you. You can follow this show on Twitter and Instagram @MyFavePod on Twitter, @MyFavorite_podcast on Instagram. Listen to the show. God damn it. Please listen to the show. You can also follow me on my socials @NoahMarger on Twitter, @Noah.Marger on Instagram. You can listen to my other podcast. It's On the List with Noah and Mason. We will be talking about, well, we do talk about, for 2 years, we've been talking about underrated albums, movies, and a whole lot more, mostly Family Guy. Sorry, Simpsons fans. You can hear us this week, actually, talking about Bromst by Dan Deacon and Gentleman Broncos from 2009 with a guy maybe you know, Jackie, maybe you know this guy, Rocky Pajarito. Ring a bell?
He sounds pretty hot.
He sounds pretty hot and maybe is your boyfriend. Yeah, he's pretty cool. He's, you know, he's only been on the show five fucking times, you know? The show's run, so who cares? And just came out today as we're recording this, but it'll have been out for a couple days already. Mason and I went on Aya versus the Big Boys to talk about Silence of the Lambs. And the episode is longer than the movie itself, which is fucked up. So if you want to hear us talk about that with Kevin and Aya, that is out now on your podcast platforms. And listen to Jackie's episode of Aya versus the Big Boys.
Yeah.
You guys talked about the comedy, right, by Rick Alverson?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, and maybe you're not such a fan of the comedy starring Tim Heidecker, and maybe that's something that you and I don't have in common, is that maybe I like that one and maybe you don't. But maybe that's a conversation. Maybe we don't do another 90 minutes just talking about that.
TikTok, Noah, time is up.
Damn, we're at midnight, folks. I'm about to be blown up. I'm about to be strapped to the fucking electric chair. Thank you for listening. Here's the song. Bye.